fresh juniper trees.
Ready when you're ready.
He said the...
Various.
I'm ready.
The various upper dollars.
Juniper.
Yes.
How many you got?
Oh, my God.
So open the House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water. Today is March 10th, 2015, and let me open a public hearing. Well, first let me say the House Bill 3028 is going to be carried over. Well, did we?
Not carried over.
Reschedule another time. The author's not quite ready of it for it, so not carried over, but we won't be dealing with 3028 today. We'll just be talking about sand control districts and then the two annexation bills. And if we're still here at 1:42 p.m., then we could do our domestic water supply bill. There's something about the paperwork that we can't do it before 1:42, so we'll see. So let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3030. And I have no idea who's here to tell me about it, but...
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
While my constituents are coming up, they brought some visual aids to show why a sand control district is an imperative in my district. I just wanted to pass those around.
Okay. Look. Ono and Wayne are my two witnesses. Oh, these are not copies. These are... Oh, Lord Almighty. Wow.
You, too, could have a house at the Oregon coast.
Well, tell us about this House Bill 3030.
Well, Chair Klim, first, thanks for the opportunity to bring this forward to you and the committee. And obviously, the many weighty things that you're dealing with this legislative session, this is probably one of a little bit different nature. Very important to us on the Oregon coast. But because it involves sand and the removal of sand...
I need you to say your name for the record. I'm
Wayne Belmont.
Thanks, Wayne.
Thanks. Lincoln County Council. It'd be easy for me to talk, first of all, about bringing the various things, kind of the humor around this, too much sand. I could talk about having people play well in the sandbox together. Don't need to do that. I do call Mr. Hughes and Mr. Sandman,
I
can do that. But actually, I do want to start off with a little bit of a joke because it tells a little bit about the nature of the issue down, especially in Bayshore and Walport. And it's in Bayshore, Oregon, you know what they call the county council buried up to his neck in sand? Not enough sand.
Bingo.
So this is an issue, a big issue for people on the coast, and really it's something that's been happening for a number of years. This has actually made the news across Oregon. I know that several of the statewide TV stations have reported on this. The events over the course of the last year or so were important enough and tragic enough that it made the news. And showing the sand that would accumulate during certain kinds of coastal events, and Mr. Husing can talk about the conditions that cause this better than I can, but it accumulates at the coast, and we need a way for the homeowners to deal with that issue. And as we looked at state law, we looked at the various players who could participate in resolving the problem of when sand does accumulate, what can you do, first of all, and then how do you pay for doing that? We found that there really was nothing available for us currently in state law that would allow homeowners to band together to try and remedy the situation of too much sand. And so therefore, we came up with the idea of creating this special district and used the template of other similar kinds of special districts, which provide for utilities, other public services, the models out there. And we just basically utilized that and applied it to the development of a sand control district. And this district would basically follow the state law, statewide planning goal 18, as well as our local code, which implements a required beach plan for this particular area, but give them the funding mechanism to actually accomplish the removal of sand in the area. And it's in the simplest form, that's what this does. And so I'm not going to really say any more unless there's any more questions. Turn it over to Mr. Husing to talk a little bit more about the problem and the solutions we have.
We'll do questions probably after.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, good to see you again.
You
Otto
too.
Husing. I'm the director of Lincoln County Planning and Development Department. Been in that role for almost 3 years now. And the day I walked in the door, this wonderful dune management plan paid for by people in Bayshore and the Department of Land Conservation and Development was like a done deal. There was one steering committee left. Everyone said, this is the greatest plan. It's scientific. All the agencies have been involved. This is going to solve things. When I looked at it, I said, well, yes and no. It's probably scientifically the best plan to manage the dune, but how on earth people are going to go into that thing, organize themselves, pull it all together, uncross their eyes, and develop a and pass the hat to hire the people that need to be done to manage the dune and carry out the removal activity and make sure all the state agencies and federal activities are happy. I was suspicious, although I kept my thoughts to a minimum because I was just walking on the door and I didn't want to second guess this wonderful planning effort. But lo and behold, I can't believe how many people I've gotten to know in Bayshore because phone calls seem to come to me. That's why you joked, Wayne, that I'm the Sandman. This is really an awful situation. It would be hardly an original observation to say maybe that part of Bayshore, the south end, should not have been developed in the first place. But it happened in the 1960s. It's a highly dynamic sand system. One minute, every 20 years, there's no sand, and people are worried about their homes being swept away. And then the other 20 years, half of the time, there's way too much sand. It's a highly dynamic ecosystem, but there is a remedy. You can move the sand out on the foredune and plant, use sand fencing, do a bunch of stuff, and mitigate the issues for the property owners there. But the governance structure, the organizational capacity to pull all this stuff together, that's what was really missing from the original plan, and that's what the sand removal district basically would do. I have received dozens of phone calls from people saying, bless you, please go get this done. I just want to figure out who I can write a check to. It's like a snow removal district in Bend, or it's just like so much at a homeowners association. It's really kind of a no-brainer. I don't think you're going to see any opposition to this. And it doesn't affect any existing authorities from any other state agencies, so we really don't bump ourselves up against OPRD or DLCD. This would be just carrying out the existing plan. And there will be a if this bill passes the legislature, it merely provides a tool to create the sand removal district. So there still would have to be a democratic process in Bayshore where we sit down and draw the lines on who's in the district and not and start figuring out how much they're going to be assessed to be part of the sand removal district. So in the spirit of full disclosure on any taxing implications for anybody, again, my own personal view is I've had dozens and dozens of people beg me to work with our county council and for Lincoln County to get involved to try to create an organizational structure that can handle this. And frankly, as we get through this, there'll be a separate, rather democratic process to say we like the direction this is going in. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will yield the floor. Although I'm not on the House floor, I will yield my testimony to any questions you have.
Any questions for these two gentlemen?
Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as I see it, you really want the power of eminent domain?
Well, can I
please?
That's
sure.
Fine. Again, what we were looking at was we were trying to do a model of what's out there for other kinds of special districts that are doing very similar kinds of services. So we the way that this was crafted was to give the same sets of authority to any other district that's similarly situated. And if those districts have that power, then this one would too.
Follow up.
And think about it in this context. If there was an undeveloped lot there that continually was accreting sand and had to be removed at a fairly expensive rate, I could see a district saying that maybe what we want to do is try and obtain that particular property so we can actually control the sand in a different way. I could see a scenario where that might be used, but highly unlikely that anybody is going to use that.
It doesn't, and the bill I see doesn't necessarily address the mechanisms for controlling the sand.
Well, it does, and I had that concern too when we originally proposed this. But if you look at Section 1, Subsection 3, that is the way that it's controlled because they have to adhere to the requirements of county ordinances. You actually cannot move sand in the county in accordance with statewide planning goal 18. That's why we had to develop, in order for them to do anything with the sand in that area, they had to develop this plan in accordance with statewide goals. And this is actually adopted into the county ordinance. So this actually sets the mechanisms for what they can do. What the district would have is the funding to do it.
And so I have not seen the larger plan, though, but I imagine if it's in accordance with Goal 18, there are severe limits on riprapping, for mm-hmm. example, to control the sand,
mm-hmm.
which is a great thing.
And then that's state law, and that's then that would have to be adhered to, too.
Okay. Well, and Mr. Chair and Representative Helm, that the authority to place riprap on the beach or repair riprap on the beach or not be allowed to have riprap on the beach is handled under the Ocean Shore Alteration Permit Program under OPRD, Oregon Public Parks Department. So it's really an entirely separate program. And so if someone suddenly wants to try to get riprap or fix a riprap that's down. See, right now there's riprap all on that outer part of Bayshore has been put there when the sand goes away. And at some point or another, nature will do this reverse thing and take all the sand away. And people will be coming to OPRD and saying, I need a permit to repair the riprap that right now is under 30 feet of sand that I can't even see. But there will be a day. It's really remarkable to stand at Bayshore and see this Sahara Desert of sand around you and realize that in a very short period of time, when an El Nino event, a profound El Nino event happens, all that stuff goes away. It's really astonishing to sit there and realize how dynamic that system is. But I promise you that's an entirely different program, and really at the heart of this is we're not changing any existing regulatory authority under all these other state programs that relate to the beach. And it really just provides us the governance and financial structure to carry out that dune plan. And that means, you know, grading the dunes down, using sand fencing, planting beach grass to create a dune out front, sort of move the sand where it needs to be, also being in compliance with FEMA flood zone things. All that has to be done. So there's a carefully prescribed set of do's and don'ts that have already been deemed in conformance with federal and state law that we're just carrying out. What's been lacking has been this, how do we raise the couple thousand dollars, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 to really hire the people and hire the professionals to go do this work instead of passing the hat and having one property owner at a time trying to knock on the doors of people that don't even live there and pull this thing together. That's why special districts in general are formed. Because trying to do something whether it's a road district or not, it's just trying to do something with neighbors or some part of an area. It requires some more social organization to get it done, and that's really what this bill would do.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Okay, seeing none. I have no other witnesses. Anybody else here to talk about sand control districts? No?
I'd be astonished.
Mr. Landauer, do you want to talk about sand control districts?
We support them.
Okay, let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3030 and open a public hearing on House Bill. Well, hold on. Let me hand the gavel over. I'll let my vice chair do it because I'm testifying on this. Okay, so let's do 2720 first. All right. We can do them both.
Slide on at the same time.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2720 and 2938. You can do them one after the other.
Let me do this the correct way and get this. So.
Lindsay.
Thank you. We adjourn the committee meeting.
Overruled.
I got your back.
For the record, I'm Brian Clem, state representative from District 21, which we are in currently. It comprises portions of Salem and unincorporated Marion County, just east of the city of Salem, which is part of why I'm here to talk to you today. House Bill 2720 is the one I'm going to talk about first. This applies to cities that have, as part of their charter, the requirement that the people in the city vote on annexations. And that's not very many in Oregon. I think the number is 33. So 33 cities where they're voting on annexations. And this is aimed at the question of when people in cities are voting on annexations, what about the people who are being voted on in the county, whether to be annexed or not? Prior to 2007, in the area of what's called island annexation law, the city would vote whether to annex an island in these cities where the charters require cities to vote. And in cities where the charters don't require the city residents to vote, the city councils would just do it. And they would vote on whether to annex somebody in an island. So certain cities, the people of the city voted, and certain cities, the city council would do it. Starting in 2000, it was either 7 or 2009, I convinced my colleagues to pass something saying that if the city was going to be holding an election anyway on the topic, that they should let the person in the island who was most affected by it also vote along with the rest of the city. And that passed and became law. So now in these cities where there's voting, if someone is in an island, not a literal island, obviously, but it's a term used for a piece of property that is now mostly surrounded by a city, those people would be able to vote, and their votes would be combined, and they then decide that, you know, the outcome of the election is what prevails. So what this gets at is at what point is the island law not the appropriate one to be using for annexing people? Because there are a lot of different methods of annexing, and the island annexation law was meant, I believe, to be for relatively small pieces of land that had been surrounded by the city and were causing service delivery problems, because you would have the sheriff or a rural fire department need to drive through a city portion of land to go to this small chunk of a few houses that were then still in the county. So what I've proposed here is a very narrow solution to this issue. If the cities are voting anyway, meaning there is going to be an election held, ballots are going to be sent out, and that is triggered by these charters, then I believe that the limit to which the people in the city should be able to sort of overwhelm the people in the island should be narrow. And the way this bill is tailored, it says if the election is about an island over 100 acres in size, make sure I get this right, so this is sounding confusing. If the island is over 100 acres in size, then the island voters would need to approve the annexation, and the city would need to approve the annexation separately and independently. We would call that a double majority. So it has to pass in the island, and it has to pass in the city. If it's under 100 acres, then it would only have to pass overall in a combined count of the two. So you would add the island of the people who are voting in the island and the people who are voting in the city together, and whoever won. And the point here being that at some point the island method is no longer an island. It's thousands and thousands of people, and there are other methods of annexation that are more appropriate to use if that's the case. In particular, in the eastern portions of my district, there are things that are near islands which contain between 5,000 and 10,000 homes. And in that case, I just feel it's not appropriate to use the island annexation law, because they're not just a few people who are causing service delivery problems. They are giant city-like sizes of people that under current law would be able to be voted in over their objection into a city by the current statutes that pertain to island annexation law. So what I did was I borrowed not quite as severe as the Washington law, but I borrowed from the Washington law the acreage limit. And the Washington law doesn't allow voting in a kind of combined majority on one or a double majority on the other. I think it just limits the size of the use of the island law. Mine is a little bit softer approach that says if you're over 100 acres, your island gets to vote on its own and be counted separately, and if you're under 100 acres, then you don't get to vote and counted separately, and you are in with the rest of the city, and whatever the outcome is, the outcome is. This is somewhat confusing, and I'm not helping the matter, but the bottom line is people in islands, in some cases, I think, don't really have a very legitimate right to object to themselves being annexed, because the fact that they are the one remaining house surrounded by the city is causing huge problems. I'm just trying to set some threshold for which cities are using island annexation law, not because it's an island, but because it's the only way they can annex people against their will. And I'm trying to get away from that if there's a legitimate issue and the person is objecting to being annexed and it's causing big problems for the city, fine. But if the island is the preferred method of annexing to get people forced into the city, whether they like it or not, that to me is an abuse of the statute, and they should use other methods to do that. Like, if there's a public health or safety issue, they can already compel the person into the city that way. If they want to try and get the person in there, they could use the annexation plan method, where they convince the people in a double majority basis to vote and come into the city. But the island one was the one that basically allowed for the person to be overwhelmed by the city's powers, which was appropriate. I just want to put some size limit on the island. So that's that one. The other one I'll talk about quickly since I'm down here is, what's the other one? 2579? No, 2938. That's okay, Mr. Chair.
Did we open a public hearing on that?
2930.
So this one is, it's a short bill, it's just a sentence. It just says that a city may not require consent to annexation of a landowner's property in exchange for the city providing a county service as an agent of the county. And I will refer you to a document that I furnished to you from 2006, a legislative council opinion. At the bottom of the first page, there's a paragraph that's kind of fuzzy. And then it's talking about, in the middle of that paragraph, it says, when a city operates a building inspection program in unincorporated areas pursuant to an intergovernmental agreement with the county, the city does not deliver its own services. Rather, the city acts as an agent of the county, delivering services on behalf of the county to the unincorporated territory. A city may require consent to annexation only for delivering its own services, not for acting as an agent of the appropriate service provider. So my belief from this legislative council opinion is that this is already current law, what this bill is proposing, that, or at least current interpretation of law, should prohibit cities from using the fact that they have been requested by another service provider to carry out a program for them. That should prohibit cities from requiring someone to annex in exchange for issuing building permits, for example, on behalf of the county that they are within under some kind of intergovernmental agreement. What I found is, at least in several cities, it has not, the current law, the interpretation of LC has not carried the day. It's not how it's being carried out statewide, and this would solidify this and codify this sort of philosophy that if the city is providing one of its own services to a county resident and the city's paid to extend those services out there, the city may rightfully say, you have to sign up to come into the city if we want to annex you, otherwise you're not getting onto our city water or our city sewer or something like that. But if the city is only doing it as a function of a service on behalf of somebody else, they should not use that opportunity to tell the person that you have to sign this consent to be annexed into our city, otherwise we're not going to deliver the service to you. Like in the case of this Tigard, it was a building permit. Washington County was asking Tigard to run the building permit program. Marion County also asked the city of Salem to run their building permit program as a cost measure. It's just cheaper to have one program than two. And for a while, at least, the city of Salem was forcing people to sign a agreement that they would not contest being annexed into the city, or else you're not going to get your Marion County building permit. And these people don't live in the city, and they weren't going to attach to city services. They were just going to remodel their bathroom or, you know, get some sort of we had a witness come in 2009 to talk about they were putting up a metal building out in the county, and they were forced to sign a non-remonstrance agreement, even though they're not in the city and they weren't looking to be in the city, and they just wanted a service that the county had subcontracted to the city. So we have other witnesses, both pro and con, I think, and so I won't spend much more time on my point of view. Sorry, this is not the best introduction I've ever given in the history of time, but this is like my fifth session on it, and so I have stopped explaining it as and bringing witnesses in and those kind of things like I used to do, which may be my downfall here.
Any questions from the committee?
Quick clarification.
That was riveting.
Representative Gilley.
The other people will do better, I promise.
I, too, am riveted. Brian, in my layman terms, going back to the first bill,
yeah,
we're saying of the two options, basically, the second option is what's in place from the bill we passed.
Yeah.
Right?
Correct. Combined and majority voting.
Okay, I just want to make sure. Yeah. It's not two new options. It's one new option, and if you don't reach that size, we revert to the bill that we
That's
passed.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, current law would apply still to the people who are under 100 acres, and then there would be this new provision that is people who are in islands over 100 acres would essentially have a veto authority over the city voters and vice versa.
And on the second bill, we're simply trying to make sure we don't tempt cities into an overreach.
Yeah, we're trying to make sure that cities don't use the fact that they're operating a service on behalf of someone else to force someone in order to get that service to agree to not fight annexation. And the way that played out in Salem, at least, was there was letters sent basically saying, you've already agreed to this, don't contest this, or, you know, we can challenge you in court. And it was pretty scary to the homeowners. In the case that I encountered, I don't think that was over building permits, it was something that the developer had already done on behalf of the property owner before they sold the house. So they had signed a non-remonstrance agreement when the property was out in the county, saying whoever buys this in the future won't contest at some point the addition of this property into the city. And the person in, I think, two of the three cases had that as part of like their deed. It was on their deed that covenant had been in place. So that's their fault for not looking at that. One of the people didn't even have that on their deed. It had never been recorded anywhere. So the city had said, we're going to sue you if you fight this. And the person had not signed anything. And the developer who had apparently signed it didn't disclose it. And so the city dropped that one and let that one go. And they annexed the other two people against their will. But it was, you know.
But it was potentially there.
Yeah. In that particular case, this would have prevented the developer, I think, from even having done it because I don't think the city was serving those properties with sewer or water or anything like that. And that's sort of the bottom line. It's if the city is, in fact, extending services to the person, you can understand why they might want to require you to annex because they paid a lot of money to get those things out there. It's when they're operating a soft service on behalf of someone else. What's their hook in it? What's their, you know, what's the reason they can force you to not fight an annexation? And when these things play out, there's other methods. When the owner has consented, there's other methods of annexation that can be used that then don't require voting, don't require elections to be held in some cases because they've already consented and it's a voluntary annexation. But you often find people with a paper in their hand saying, I am not voluntarily being annexed, but yet this document here that I had to do to remodel my bathroom says I'm voluntarily doing it. And it's always awkward in those scenarios because the person signed the paper. So at that point, you know, in LC's opinion, the city was violating the law and even having him do that. And so this would make it very clear in statute versus just an LC opinion that cities may not do that as when they're acting as an agent of another service provider. And actually, it's not even another service provider. All it is just a county when they're acting as an agent of a county. We probably should broaden it, actually, to be all other kinds of service providers right now, just as counties. And you have some folks here from both cities to talk about why I'm sure it's problematic and from the
kind of folks who work on annexation issues to talk about what's going on around the state and where this has been a problem.
Any other questions? Okay. For House Bill 2720, I'll invite Aaron Doyle. And I think, Aaron, you might as well give your testimony on both bills, and then we'll invite the other folks.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Helm, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. I'll first address House Bill 2720, which is related to the island annexation, where we have a requirement in our charter to vote. First, we do oppose this bill because we think it kind of counters the intention of the land use system and highlights some of the technical problems between how our land use system is supposed to work, and we're supposed to do 20 years worth of planning and create these UGBs, and how our annexation system has never really been fit comfortably into that land use system. When it comes to large islands like this, some of them might have thousands of people, some of them might have one owner who wants to come in, but because of our charter amendments for the particular cities that have them, there has to be an election, regardless of whether or not the folks in the island want to come in or not. That's what our charter says, so there's always an election. So part of the issue is that there's no population cap tied to that 100 acres. But more importantly, it's really a way for people to continue to live inside of a city without being residents of the city. So they don't live in the city, they live inside the city, because that's what an island is. It's the piece of property that's unincorporated within the city limits, because it's surrounded on all sides by definition of an island. And making it more difficult to bring these people, to bring those residents in based on a voting requirement that lets them veto, it means that when we look at our buildable land supply and our UGB, we have these 100 acres that we have to account for because they're inside the UGB. That might be further developable. That might be land that we could add more residences to, or more commercial or more industrial. And we have to count it in our buildable land supply, but we can't bring those folks into the city because they have veto power, which means we have to do one of two things: further expand our UGB out into areas that are unincorporated and maybe won't face the same island problem, or be stuck with that 100 acres being there, unannexable, but also counting against us in our buildable land supplies. So that's one way in which the tension between annexation and the land use system plays out if we tinker with the voting requirements to allow veto power. Because what it comes down to is the folks who live in these islands, when they are heavily populated, who feel like they're living in a city already, they get a lot of the amenities of living within the city without having to pay the property taxes that everyone else that does live in the city and has been annexed into the city has to pay for. Instead, they can just pay the county and whatever special districts taxes and the education taxes, but they get out of that city level property tax, but they can still access things, sometimes for a minimal charge. For example, of a library, if you live in the area, you can access the library without being a resident, but you pay a minimal fee. But parks and other services that are traditionally provided by a city to its residents and paid for through the property taxes are not being paid for by those folks who can still access those areas. So by allowing them the veto power, they get the luxury of living within the city limits without having to pay literally pay the consequences of that. And by providing them the veto power, you're putting the burden on the residents of the cities who may or may not support the annexation to cover that charge. In all, we think that this bill would go counter to a lot of the policies of how cities are trying to do annexation now. More and more often we're looking for the agreement because we've found that the fight is too difficult to try and bring folks in who are not wanting to come in. And even with the 100-acre cap really limiting the utility of this alternative method of counting, there are a number of cities that are that might possibly be looking at this outside of Salem, and the effects of this bill on those cities really limits their ability to do proper land use planning and really account for who lives where and how they develop and how much density is in that development and all of those things that we're required to do using the land use system. And for that reason, we fundamentally oppose this bill. And do you want questions first?
We don't have anybody else, so questions for Aaron. The two of you.
I do not. Thank you.
I had no idea I had the power to drive people out of a room so effectively. As to House Bill 2938, I checked the opposed box, and it's more of a difficulty with how the ramifications of House Bill 2938 would work for some of our cities. When it comes to things like building permits in exchange for non-remonstrance agreements, there has been a lot of controversy around that. And I know in the city of Salem, they fixed that issue locally by having their their council went and talked to their building codes folks and said, you're stretching way too far. Let's roll that back. We've solved that issue locally here in Salem. I'm not familiar with the other examples, except for in the instances when a city has an agreement to provide the service, and part of that agreement is with the county to have these folks annexed in using non-remonstrance. On occasion, that intergovernmental agreement by which we provide the service will include that provision, and how the county has us doing it, because that's what the county wants. These folks are inside the UGB, and the easier we make it to annex them, the sooner they're out of the county and they can develop to the full urban level, and we can take advantage of the whole purpose of the UGB. So in those instances, it's been raised to my attention by legal minds far smarter than me that we might be running into a contracts clause issue. We're not sure. We have no idea how that would play out. But if the county's urban intergovernmental agreement requires us to ask for the non-remonstrance agreement, this would be interfering with that contract, which is difficult. And that's more where our concern lies. We don't believe that many of our cities are doing this anymore. We've had conversations. I haven't heard from many folks who say that this is something that they do for these soft services like building codes, or you know, if you wanted to go to the library, you had to sign a non-remonstrance. I don't think that anybody's doing that, and we're hoping that no one's doing the building codes piece anymore either. We do appreciate the distinction that's being made between hard infrastructure and those soft services, because when we extend the infrastructure out, sometimes it is by intergovernmental agreement, but that's a big investment, and we need to be able to do bonding against to ensure capacity. So we appreciate that concession with this, and are more concerned about the contract ramifications for this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm in a different position than you are. There is probably only one legal mind greater than mine, and it's our vice chair. But I would say this, that we are in agreement that we don't want to misuse the leverage of providing services. However, hoping, given how many folks are in your league, hoping that nobody's doing it concerns me, and I'm leaning towards nailing this down and saying from the get-go, cities, you understand, you may not. I hope you agree with that, and I can understand, you know, that you need to be careful with your cities, but I'm leaning towards this bill.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, it's a policy decision for you to make about where this gets brought up. Is it when we do our legal analysis internally, or if it's clearly laid out in statute? And at this point, we're not sure of what cities would be affected by that, other than those that are looking at intergovernmental agreements and saying, well, what do we do now?
Follow-up.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up.
Do you feel like you've had enough time, maybe you haven't, to fully vet this with the league? Do you need some more time to ask your cities?
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, this is not a new issue in this session.
I was gonna ask.
So it's not an issue of the policy itself. It's that we're not sure what a court would decide related to the intergovernmental agreement issue and if it would be raised anywhere, depending upon how things would be negotiated in the future between cities and counties.
Thank you.
Okay, so I've got Jerry Ritter and Joseph Off. Are you Joseph?
I'm Joseph.
Come on up. If you would care to testify, I have you on my sign-up sheet anyway. Richard, are you coming up or no? Let's see. Okay. Jerry, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Jerry Ritter, representing Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexation. OCVA was formed in 1996 to protect the voter annexation local laws that Representative Clem referenced in his last testimony. Corvallis started the first one in 1976. OCVA today is a coalition of citizens groups in 33 communities around the state with a 500,000 population that have given themselves the ability to approve annexations by the initiative process. It's been a struggle protecting those because there are public and private entities who have been trying for decades to outlaw them, even though the highest courts have upheld that right. So that's where we have been busy. We also led the successful effort in 2005 to reform ORS 195 and in 2007 to reform ORS 222-750. Our ongoing mission is to ensure that citizens have a meaningful voice in annexation decisions, to put the citizens before special interests, and to ensure fairness in state annexation laws, which brings us to House Bill 2938. First of all, Mr. Chairman, thank you for sponsoring this legislation to rein in hostage annexations. I can assure you that it is going on. It's certainly going on in Lane County with the citizens of Eugene and outside the city limits. And you can check with Senator Edwards on that. He can fill you in on some of the problems in his district with it, especially after the Boundary Commission was eliminated. We proposed a language for this bill, and we urge the committee to move it to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Our arguments are threefold. First of all, lack of necessity. We have never seen a legitimate reason.
Pull back just a little bit from the mic.
Oh, sorry about that. I'm having a difficult time speaking today. Our first reason is lack of necessity. We have never seen a legitimate reason for a city to require consent to annexation in exchange for providing a county service as an agent of that county. And we describe building permits, which you've already talked about. The second is the Legislative Council opinion that Representative Clem has already addressed, so I don't need to revisit that. I have a little bit cleaner copy here if you want me to leave it with your committee administrator. And the third issue, and the most important one, is fairness. Why should citizens have to have their property tax as much as doubled and be faced with thousands of dollars in assessments just for getting something like a building permit? I would ask that you put yourself in the position of such a citizen and ask how you would feel about it. This bill does not deny the right of cities to require annexation in exchange for providing a city service. We're simply asking that the LC opinion be codified into law. The part of our original language that eliminated the ability of cities to avoid the bill's requirements through an IGA or a comp plan was not adopted when the bill was drafted, and that concerns us somewhat. Ms. Doyle referenced the possible problems with IGAs and comp plans for the conflict, and we would hope that the language as written is intended to supersede any of that. You also may hear arguments, and you already have, about fairness of a different issue, that being citizens outside the city supposedly being subsidized by the city. Mr. Chairman, you and we have heard that argument repeatedly over the last several sessions. We have never seen any facts and data to back that claim up. The facts and data we have seen are included here in this comprehensive service incident report that was done by the Washington County auditors back in 2005. They found no such evidence, and in fact, their conclusion was something quite different. And I'll be happy to leave this with your committee administrator as well. Anyway, we hope that you will consider this bill and appreciate again the opportunity to testify. This is something that needs to be done, and we hope you will move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll be happy to entertain any questions.
Great. Joseph?
Hi, my name is Joseph Hoff. I live 325 Northwest Korean 34th Avenue, Hillsborough, Oregon, 97124. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today on House Bill 2938. My neighborhood would like to see this bill do more by finding a way to opt out of annexation in order to protect farm deferral. The rural residents and farmers on Northwest 334th, 336th, 338th, and 344th Avenues and Iona Court north of 12th and Valley Highway were added into the urban growth boundary through House Bill 4078 in the 2014 legislature. The residing landowners of these streets do not want their land to be placed in the urban growth boundary, which they are now, and I submitted some petitions into for public record. They also do not want to be annexed into the city of Cornelius. The city of Cornelius has started their concept planning process to determine infrastructure needs when our neighborhood gets annexed into the city. It is my understanding that the city can force annexation by Oregon Revised Statute 222 if a landowner needs to connect into the sewer system because the Department of Environmental Quality will deny a permit application for fixing a septic system when a property is within 300 feet of a sewer line. And this is referenced in Oregon Administrative Rule 340.07.160. If someone's land is annexed into the city, the landowner may lose their farm deferral or will not be able to pass the farm deferral to their children. We want the Oregon legislature to create an exception to this rule so we can protect generation farmers. Oregon is a transplant state. Generational families living on the same land are rare. My wife's family currently resides on land their family has lived on for six generations. My neighbors with cows and other livestock plan to pass their land to their children to continue to farm. If they lose their farm deferral, they are financially forced to sell their land to developers. In their concept planning process, the city of Cornelius is looking at placing the sewer line along Oregon Department of Transportation Railroad right-of-way adjacent to these farms. The sewer line would be run by Clean Water Services. We would like to see Oregon Revised Statute 222 give some form of an exemption by either giving a landowner the opportunity to fix their septic system when their land is within 300 feet of a sewer line if there are no health issues, or placing language in the Oregon Revised Statute 222 that gives a landowner with farm deferral or other forms of tax breaks for farming the option of not annexing when connecting into the sewer system as long as the landowner pays the city or county a fee for the sewer service. We also welcome any ideas the House Committee of Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water may have to find a way to protect a farmer's farm deferral. Our neighborhood did not have an opportunity to have a voice during the House Bill 4078 process. Hopefully we can have a voice on annexation. Thank you.
So we do have a bill you might be interested in. I can't quite remember the number, but it has to do with urban agricultural zones, and it would be a tool for see if we can find it here. We'll see if we can get you the number, but it would be a tool to continue to allow farm deferral even within urban growth boundaries.
Okay.
I sponsored it, so it's not up for hearing yet, but it might be what you're looking for, or one of the options anyway. And actually, you know, I'm just not sure. We'd probably need a county assessor person here, but I'm not entirely sure it's a requirement of a county that they remove the farm deferral if it's in a UGB versus the use itself determines whether it's in farm deferral. So if you're still farming inside a UGB, I don't know that they have to take it off or not.
I talked to Washington County's tax assessor, and he said that his name was Eric Olson, and my understanding from the conversation is that this past summer like when land gets pulled into the urban growth boundary, it gets put into like an urban limbo zoning, and it's called Future Development 20 in Washington County. And we were able to protect our rural zoning, and so Washington County let us keep our rural zoning and not put that urban limbo zoning on us. And because we're successful in that, according to their tax assessor, that we were able to keep our farm deferral. But if we were somehow changed into that FD20 zoning, my understanding is that we would lose that right to have farm deferral.
So it probably isn't that you're required to just because you're in the UGB. It's more about the specific zone. And I think this other bill that I'm talking about, House Bill 2723, this would authorize a county, a city, to designate an urbanized area as an urban agricultural incentive zone. And then they can enter into agreement with the owner in order to basically keep their special assessment. Yeah. That might be the way to go about it.
And you're correct. It's based on the zoning.
Yeah.
So as long as you're able to maintain the rural zoning.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's helpful. I'm not totally sure it applies to our other bill, but it's good to have you here anyway so we know about this. Any questions for either of these two gentlemen? Okay. I think that is all for you. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
And let's close the public hearing on House Bills 2938 and 2720. We have enough people here. We can do our work session on, I forgot the name of the little water control district.
Rainbow.
Rainbow. Rainbow. Rainbow. Yeah. Everybody here okay moving along on this one? The Rainbow Water District? I'm seeing nobody panicked. Okay.
Chair, it's past 1:42. I don't think we can do it.
No, we now can do it.
Oh, we can.
Let me open a work session on House Bill 2579.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments of House Bill 2579, dated January 22nd, 2015.
Vice Chair Helm moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 2579. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that HB 2579.
Just in case I didn't open the work session. I thought I did, but if I didn't open the work session, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2579, and let's redo that last one again, just in case.
Mr. Chair, I move HB 2579 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
First, if you could move the adopt the -1 amendments, just in case I did that outside of a work session.
Okay, so we're going to repeat.
Yeah, sorry.
So,
about
Mr.
That.
Chair, I once again move to adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 2579, dated January 22nd, 2015.
Vice Chair Helm moves the -1 amendments dated 1/22/15 to House Bill 2579. This time, is there any discussion now that we're legitimately doing this?
Mr. Chairman,
could
we review our individual votes last time for consistency?
Yeah, could the clerk do that?
And so, reread the whole entire.
And the whole, would you like me to read the whole bill?
Yes.
And the -1 amendments?
No, I'm good with the -1, but I would like you to read the bill.
Should we bring LC in to discuss both the bill and the amendments?
I love being here.
All right. So any objection to the -1 amendments this time? Seeing none. And Vice Chair Helm.
Mr. Chair, I move that HB 2579 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Helm moves House Bill 2579 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomber.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Excused.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Excused.
Chair Plum.
Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent to the floor. This bill was Representative Barnhart's bill. Unless there's Well, actually, there probably is legitimate objection to having him carry the bill, because you know, never know what we might get into and what other topics we might learn about from the multiple advanced degree holder. But I think we should probably let him have it anyway, because it is, in fact, his bill. So we'll have him carry the bill. And I will, I'll talk with folks offline about the other bills. I have some responses to the clever and devious Erin Doyle, who has once again foiled me in, with her argumentation skills, but I will discuss them offline, because she is too talented for me to try and deal with it in public. And I will adjourn the committee. Thanks.